I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast that we do every week. It's a weekly show and a weekly podcast. So, by the way, we have lots of podcasts in the queue. If you want to visit our website, it is throttleupradio.com, but it's also found on iTunes, and so you can go there and just type in Throttle Up Radio and you get it there. Okay, so, well, we are in the middle of a pandemic, the coronavirus catastrophe that has swept the world, and we're trying to make sense out of it, trying to, well, come up with something that is helpful, useful, that goes beyond just a mere panic or hysteria that seems to be the order of the day. So I'm sitting here in my recording studio looking out a window, a great view, and it's a beautiful day, and I find it a little bit hard to be depressed, but there is, well, I guess you could say there is good news and there is bad news. So it's a mix, and we have to be able to deal with it, and we have to, I guess, we have to think in terms of how should I think about this stuff that we have encountered. And that's probably a pretty good start, and it probably frames the argument in terms of what we are trying to accomplish here on this radio show. What we're trying to put forth, what we're trying to deal with. Now, keep in mind that Throttle Up Radio is all about thinking, and we use the term critical thinking a lot. We also use the term power of reason. We use the term higher order reason a lot, and other aspects of it. And there are certain sub-aspects of what I would consider to be, well, the first and foremost, it would be higher order reasoning. That would be the top of my list. And then beneath that, I would organize it this way. To the left side would be, this is kind of a, like a hierarchy, if you can visualize a hierarchy. So the top layer of the hierarchy is higher order reasoning. Beneath that, going from left to right, is, in my view, is critical thinking. And then it goes, or identifies other aspects of that. That includes such things as systems thinking. It includes such things as design thinking, if you are involved in some kind of a design initiative. It also includes systems thinking, which is becoming more and more popular. And the last one on my particular list is big picture thinking. But, you know, if I had to think about it and refine that hierarchy, I might put that the top layer might be higher order reasoning. Yes, so that would be my choice. Beneath that would be big picture thinking. I think they go hand in glove. And then the third layer of the hierarchy would be critical thinking and systems thinking and design thinking. So, and then we could add other things, but that pretty much covers it in terms of what we're trying to deal with. So we are, in fact, all about thinking. So how should we think about this coronavirus? How should we deal with it? So this is a continuing show about the coronavirus, but it also is a show that identifies a point in time. And I would say that this is a transition point here, that we are now in a transition point, or we have reached a transition point. Transition from what to what? Well, transition from the immediate steps necessary to deal with a global pandemic to a more ordered lifestyle, to a return, at least to a certain extent, a return to a normal lifestyle that one would expect in a modern industrial society. Okay, that's fair. And so how do we transition into that? Well, you know, there's two ways to do this. Of course, we could have the authoritarian model, which we have employed, by the way, to, in my view, to mixed success, because I don't think it's been entirely successful, but we have done such. And the authoritarian model, I'll give you an example here. A couple of days ago, I traveled to Zion National Park. Now, that's in southern Utah, and it's not very far away from where my winter home is. And I went to Zion National Park to go for a bike ride. They have a nice scenic road that's great for walking, hiking, and bike riding. And lo and behold, Zion National Park is closed to visitors. I'm not making this up. Okay, it's closed. So, but there is a small section of road that is open because the road is actually part of a state highway. So there's a state highway that actually goes through part of the park. It's a Utah Highway 9 is the road. So that road was open. And so it was, it was a place where I could bike, certainly. And so my trip there was successful, but it was really, it struck me as being really quite outrageous that they have closed the park because of the criteria for social distancing, whatever that means. Okay, so I inquired to the local people there, and this is what I got. I said, well, Zion National Park was becoming heavily visited during the early stages of the pandemic and the shutdown. Lots of people came to the park because there was very limited things that they could do recreationally. And the park was in the adjoining town called Springdale, Utah, was overwhelmed with people, but most of their restaurants were closed. The hotels, as far as I can tell, were not closed, but the restaurants are closed, and as well as some of the other shops and stuff like that. And so the town didn't know what to do, and they went to the state, and the state then went to the National Park Service and got them to agree to close the park. Okay, so that's what happened, but really, was that an intelligent way to go? Or certainly that's the authoritarian model, which a lot of people cannot conceive of anything beyond that. But maybe there was a better, let's say, for argument, we could say that there was a different way to go about that and still provide some reasonable levels of protection against contagion. Okay, so what is the thing that we want to do? We want to protect against contagion. We want to reduce by a measurable and considerable amount the person-to-person contagion of this virus. The virus doesn't really live very long outside of an infected biological entity. Okay, and what is the evidence that it is transmittable in the great outdoors, in open spaces? What is the evidence that the coronavirus, and as well as others, is transmittable from person to person in the great outdoors? There is evidence, and this ought to be obvious to everybody, all right, but it doesn't seem to be. There is evidence that the virus outdoors is not very transmittable, and it also doesn't live very long. It doesn't live long in certain environments that which you would encounter the rays of the sun, UV rays, the ultraviolet rays, also sunlight, if you will. It doesn't seem to be long-lived in sunlight conditions. Of course, in outdoors, you have the wind, you have it quickly dispersed in the atmosphere so that there is, within any given cubic space of the air, you have fewer coronavirus droplets just because it's just blown away is basically what happens. Okay, so I began to think about how we go about solving problems in this country. And I think that there is a pressing need for us to get a lot better in the area of critical thinking and complex problem solving. I really do. That, by the way, the World Economic Forum has identified those two things as the most important skill sets in the global job market and second to none. So, you know, I think that we need, instead of saying, well, we need a vaccine, we need a surefire protection against this pandemic, we need a vaccine for coronavirus, but will that cover other pandemics that come from other places? Well, not really. It just happens to be an easy way to think about it. I think that the first thing, well, we could also say that in parallel to the the medicines that we could test and prove effective and distribute, pharmaceuticals, as well as vaccines. I think we also ought to be looking strongly on our ability to think clearly during crises, the ability to think clearly during conditions that we might consider to be mission critical. So when you go to a normal environment to a mission critical environment, do you carry with you the same skills and cognitive attributes that you had, or do you need something else beyond what you would normally use in a normal environment? And the answer is you need something else. And we are not very good at identifying what that is, and we're not very good at providing that which is necessary for us to operate effectively in non-normal environments. Non-normal environments, we could classify, I have my own classification scheme, but I utilize mission critical, and then from there, there is also an aspect of reality in which things are becoming unstable. That's called critical state in some scientific circles. I call it chaos. So you either have chaos. And then beyond chaos, the last area of reality that we could say exists or is known to exist is catastrophic conditions. So we have normal, mission critical, chaotic, and catastrophic four conditions. And for each one, we need to equip ourselves with specialized equipment, cognitive apparatus, to be able to deal with it effectively, deal with those things that come up in such that we can continue to survive and we can continue to prosper and we can continue to protect those loved ones. So that's where I'm coming from. Anyway, so we're going to read a piece in the Wall Street Journal. I think it's particularly important here, and that sort of like sets the stage for a couple of other audio clips that we'll play. This happens to be the title of this piece is Reopening the U.S. Economy, Even If the Pandemic Endures. The article is by Avik Roy, and the sub piece there is that it says that it's not true that the only way to improve public health is by shutting down the economy, and the only way to improve the economy is by sacrificing public health. So this argument, and you know, just from that perspective, I would say that this is probably something that we ought to consider. It's probably something that should inform us, hopefully, as we go forward in what we believe is the best course of action as we approach this midpoint where we are considering what I call the opening. We have endured the shutdown for basically for a month. Now we need to address ourselves to the opening. So we start reading. I'll read and make some comments along the way. As the COVID-19 shutdown enters its second month, policymakers and commentators have emphasized that we're not yet out of the woods. Deaths and hospitalizations are continuing to rise, albeit more slowly than before. The flattening curves have encouraged some people to talk about reopening the economy and others to rise in protest against ongoing restrictions. But most Americans remain cautious. He says that we've been willing to endure the staggering economic damage because we're convinced that it's necessary for public health and that the lockdowns won't last too long. Indeed, a kind of conventional wisdom has emerged among public health officials and policy experts. We're told that life will go back to normal just as soon as we've reached a series of public health milestones, which are near universal testing, the development of effective treatments, and the emergence of herd immunity, and ultimately approval of a vaccine. Mr. Rory goes on to say that, but this conventional wisdom has a critical flaw. We've taken for granted that our ingenuity can solve almost any problem, but what if in this case it can't? What if we can't scale up coronavirus testing as quickly as we need to do? What if it takes us 6 or 12 months instead of 3 to identify an effective treatment for COVID-19? What if those who recover from the disease fail to gain immunity and are therefore susceptible to getting reinfected? And what if it takes us years to develop a vaccine? Okay, those are good questions. He goes on to say, once we start asking these questions, a terrible truth becomes clear, which is the scenario in which we meet all the public health milestones and then return to our regularly scheduled economic programming is highly optimistic. A more realistic scenario is that we will fail to reach one or more of the milestones. If that happens, do we prolong the economic shutdown for 6 months or longer? Do we impose a series of on and off stay-at-home orders that could go on for years? The damage from a prolonged economic shutdown is difficult to contemplate, he says. Tens of millions of Americans have already lost their jobs. Countless small businesses have closed, many for good. 2 months ago, 20% unemployment seemed unthinkable. 2 months from now, 20% unemployment might seem like the good old days. And he goes on, Americans are optimistic by nature, and the public is right to hope for the best. Policymakers must prepare for the worst. And that means we must consider options for reopening the economy in a world in which we have not completely controlled the COVID-19 pandemic. Time is of the essence. Every week matters. A 2016 study by JP Morgan Chase Institute found that the median small business holds just 27 days worth of cash in reserve. So that's about a month's worth of cash. Okay. For restaurants, retail shops, and construction firms, the buffer is even thinner. The good news is that there are ways to get America back to work. While we control the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19, we need to escape from the false dichotomy, which insists that the only way to improve public health is by shutting down the economy, and the only way to improve the economy is by sacrificing public health. How hard will it be to achieve the conventional public health milestones? Harder than it looks, he says. Consider testing. There are two principal kinds of tests, those that detect if a patient has developed antibodies to the virus and those that measure viral RNA levels in a patient's nasal secretions. Both have significant technical limitations. Antibody tests often suffer from accuracy problems and can fail to detect inactive infection. Viral RNA tests are highly accurate, but most versions must be administered in a clinical setting like a doctor's office or a hospital, making them difficult to scale up. He says to match the modestly high levels of coronavirus testing for which South Korea has been praised, the U.S. would need to administer 7 million tests a week. We'll be fortunate if we reach half that number by September. He goes on to say that there's good reason to be confident that we eventually find an effective treatment against COVID-19. According to the Milken Institute, there are more than 150 drugs being actively tested against the disease. Some of them are likely to work, but when will we know? The first drug to get some positive buzz was hydroxychloroquine, but in the latest published clinical trials, more patients on the drug died relative to those taking placebos. All right. Now, just having said that, I would point out that particular piece of medical information is now being questioned by a number of experts. So I would kind of take that with a grain of salt. Nevertheless, over the past week, Remdesivir, a failed Ebola drug, was generating excitement because of positive anecdotal data out of Chicago. And so he's talking about these drugs which may or may not be working effectively. And so he's kind of painting a bleak picture about the pharmaceuticals. I would suggest, from what I have been able to uncover, and I've been following this fairly closely, I would say that the pharmaceuticals are more promising than what a lot of people think. Particularly, chloroquine is quite promising, and we need to have a more optimistic point of view from that. It does seem to have quite a stellar record. Sure, there's going to be some setbacks, and it's not going to be quite as rosy as what we once thought, but I would not dismiss any of that. And then he goes on to say that what if the antibodies do not confer immunity, or if the protection doesn't last very long? This is a very real possibility based on our experience with other coronaviruses, like the original SARS from 2003 and even the common cold. The same issue. I would say that, my point of view here is the effects of the common cold have been significantly reduced by the application of zinc. So when you take zinc, the effects of the common cold are reduced. If you take it soon enough, you can actually prevent the cold from manifesting itself. You may have some viruses that you have encountered, but the zinc is a key ingredient here. And it is, in fact, a pharmaceutical, and it does work against the virus. Okay, then he goes on to say that the same issue may make it hard for biotech companies to develop an effective vaccines. Okay, he talks about vaccines, and he paints a kind of a mixed picture. And then he goes on to say that for these reasons, it's essential for the U.S. to move rapidly away from an unrealistic checklist of public health milestones and to focus instead on the specific biology of the new coronavirus and specific evidence of how COVID-19 spreads. If we do that, will find that we have better options to reopen the economy than we once believed. Okay, now I would sort of like to hear what he has to say, and so my attention is piqued. So let me continue. The starting point for a more realistic strategy is the key fact that not everyone is equally susceptible to hospitalization and death due to COVID-19. There is considerable evidence that younger people largely avoid the worst health outcomes. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, those over the age of 65 are 22 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than those under 55. That is not to say that younger people are invulnerable. We've seen significant numbers of deaths among those of middle age and above who suffer from chronic diseases like high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and kidney failure. Men appear to have nearly twice the fatality rate of women. Still, the much lower incidence of death among younger people warrants a reconsideration of our one-size-fits-all approach to stay-at-home policy, especially outside the hard-hit tri-state region of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. So, he goes on to say, to start, states and localities should work as quickly as possible to reopen pre-K and K through 12 schools. Children have a very low risk of falling seriously ill to COVID-19, and the majority can and should return to school this academic year. Switzerland, for example, is planning to reopen schools on May 11th based upon research showing that school closures were among the least effective measures at reducing European COVID-19 cases. Children who live within the elderly or other at-risk individuals should continue to stay home. Teachers and staff from vulnerable populations should stay home as well with paid leave. School districts should immediately begin to develop virtual lesson plans for those who must remain home. Similarly, we should reopen workplaces to healthy, non-elderly individuals who don't live with vulnerable people. Okay, so let's see. He goes on to say, he talks about nursing homes. And then he goes on to say, while we're reopening the schools and the economy to lower risk individuals and protecting the vulnerable, we should make sure that we're using modern public health techniques to help slow the spread of the virus. The most important of these is contact tracing. And then he talks about reopening the schools. And then he talks about there are more things that we can do to help improve our economy. And then he continues. So what we're going to do here is we're going to segue into, I want to cover one more thing before the end of the show. And that has to do with an audio clip that I think is important for us to consider as we go forward. So we're going to take a short break and be right back. Okay, welcome back. Now, this audio clip is from features a gentleman by the name of Joshua Phillip. He has recently completed a documentary on coronavirus, the coronavirus, and he is being interviewed by the Epoch Times on their program American Thought Leaders. And, you know, I'd like to point out as a consumer of information, I'd like to point out that I think they do a particularly good job. Again, this is not an endorsement in any way, shape, or form. I'm just pointing out things that come along that I think we ought to all be aware of in terms of what else is going on in the world that deals with our ability to think clearly and to think critically. So this show is all about that. And it tries to embrace lots of things out there that are going on currently that relate to what we're trying to achieve here on Throttle Up Radio, what we're trying to achieve as thinking humans, what we're trying to achieve as people who can support their power of reason. All right, so here we go. This is rather fascinating, and we won't be able to get through all of it, but we'll get through a fair amount of it, and I think it'll be worth listening to.
It is not unusual for viruses to leak from laboratories. It is not unusual. And coming from a laboratory does not necessarily mean man-made. Virus leaks from laboratories have happened before in China. SARS got out at least twice in China. Now, any reasonable investigation into this virus would have looked into that laboratory.
Where did Wuhan coronavirus, or CCP virus, really originate? Why was the wet market, the supposed source of the virus, destroyed? And what actual evidence is there connecting COVID-19 to the P4 biolab in Wuhan? In this episode, we sit down with Joshua Philip, a senior investigative reporter at the Epoch Times and host of Crossroads. He stars in the new Epoch Times documentary, Tracking Down the Origin of Wuhan Coronavirus. This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelik. Joshua Phillips, so great to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Hey, great to be here, Jan.
Tell me a little bit about what you found.
Well, you know, we started this documentary with kind of an issue that I had been seeing, and I'm sure a lot of people have been seeing. I'm sure most people watching this have been seeing, which is we're bombarded with information. And a lot of it is contradictory. We hear both sides. We hear fake news. We hear real news. We hear random bits of information. And I guarantee you, I mean, I've gone through it. I'm sure a lot of people have gone through it as well, that it's very hard to put it all together. And so I think there's this global confusion. I feel it too, right? There's this global confusion when it comes to trying to make sense of this whole virus and what's happening. And during a time when I'm working at home a lot. A lot of people are working at home. A lot of people who are essential staff and still going out, you're really going into the unknown every day. You feel like you're in a situation that you can't make sense of. It feels very dangerous. You're being told it's not that dangerous. You're being told it's super deadly. And, you know, how do you make sense of this? And so what we wanted to do with this film is to really just show a comprehensive view of all of the available information, show what is true, what can be proved, what cannot be proved, look into, you know, what are the different rumors? Can we verify these rumors? What is the legitimate path and what actually happened? And I think the audience feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. A lot of people really felt a lot of relief after having seen this film because finally they can make sense of the situation they're in.
You know, it's remarkable because there's so many different threads, I guess, that you have to be kind of put together to try to understand something here. One of the big challenges, of course, is that the Chinese Communist Party, which governs ultimately China, refrained from providing a heck of a lot of meaningful information. And as the film says, actually, something that was very valuable was, of course, the DNA sequencing of the virus itself. But the moment that that got out, when that was published, that operation was basically shut down. Clearly, they weren't supposed to even do that. Yeah. So it's fascinating. So tell me, what are some of these pieces that you discovered?
Well, so we start, of course, with the main narrative. What was the main narrative? That this virus came from a bat at the Wuhan seafood market, right? That was the narrative almost everybody was first told. That was the narrative a lot of people heard. And then we start hearing that maybe that's not the real narrative. Maybe there's something more to it. Now, what was the real story with that wet market? The Chinese Communist Party says this virus came from a bat at this wet market. People started circulating these viral images of a person eating this bat soup. They were pretty disturbing images.
Right.
Turns out that image wasn't even from that marketplace. It wasn't even from that area. It was completely unrelated. It was shown to be fake news, even though it was published all over the place. But it created this perception that maybe that's the case. Maybe that is where it started. Now, it just so happens that soon after the Chinese Communist Party came out with that, there were Western scientists who looked into the data and found that the patient zero and many of the early cases, about a third of them, had no connection whatsoever to that seafood market. And then the Chinese Communist Party itself made a criteria of diagnosis that one of the criteria of diagnosis was that the person had to have had contact with the seafood market. You could not be said to have had the virus unless you had contact with it. Why would they do that, right? So in other words, you could have the entire virus sequence, which was part of the criteria. You could have all the symptoms, which was part of the criteria. But if you did not have contact with that marketplace, you would not be diagnosed as having the virus. Why would they do that? And then here's what else they did. They went into that marketplace and they destroyed it. They got rid of everything. Now, if this was a murder scene, if this was a crime scene, that's equivalent to going in, getting rid of the body, getting rid of the blood, getting rid of the fingerprints, wiping down the whole place and saying, okay, the foreign investigators can come and have a look now. And what are they going to see? They're going to see nothing, right? And when you're dealing with a virus like this that allegedly leaped from a bat to an intermediary species, which we still don't know what was, into a human, you need to know what the intermediary species was. Chinese Communist Party told the world it was the pangolin. That was proven to be false. They lied about that. They lied about the origin. They lied about the intermediary species, and they destroyed the crime scene. And so what is the world going on right now, right? And so this was the first big thing we look into in the film, this whole story of this wet market, the seafood market. And on top of that, how did the Chinese Communist Party claim that it came from that wet market? They went and they swabbed the surfaces. They did not test the animals at that marketplace. Now, we make an analogy in the film that's equivalent to there being, for example, a large number of food poisonings at a specific restaurant. And when investigators go in, instead of testing the food, they swab the tables. That's what the Chinese Communist Party did. They didn't test the animals. They swabbed the surfaces. And that, now from a basic level, even if we were to believe that it did come from this marketplace, that would mean that had there been an intermediary species that was infecting humans, that animal is still out there and still infecting humans. You cannot stop ongoing outbreaks until you deal with that. And we were never told what that was. When they did tell us, it turned out they lied to us. And so this does bring up the serious question of, okay, where did it come from? Then, of course, the Chinese regime releases part of the virus sequence. And as you noted, yes, they released it, then they retracted it. They did not allow their own researchers to look into it. They could not write about it. And when they first did release it, there was a lot of noise about it. There was a lot going on. And then suddenly, dead silence. Why did they restrict looking into that? Why did they do that? And so there are a few interesting things when we start looking to the sequence itself. Now, the main bat coronavirus just so happens the closest match is to this Zhushan bat, right? Submitted to this virus data bank by the PLA, the Chinese military. Okay. Just so happens, right? Closest match. And then these spike proteins, these little mushroom-looking things coming off the virus cell, the virus itself, these are the things that make it human transmittable. This bat coronavirus allegedly is not naturally human transmittable, although there are some exceptions to it, which we'll get into if you'd like. The closest match to that, it's a closer match, we would say, to the SARS virus. So the question is, how did a bat coronavirus submitted to this virus data bank by the Chinese military, it appears, merge somehow with the SARS virus? Well, there is a few different options. There's recombination or there's mutation. It does not appear to be a mutation. It appears to be a recombination, according to the experts we interviewed. We interviewed some pretty good experts. And so how did that happen? Recombination does not necessarily absolutely mean man-made. Now, the real bizarre thing is it is not unusual for viruses to leak from laboratories. It is not unusual. And coming from a laboratory does not necessarily mean man-made. Virus leaks from laboratories have happened before in China. SARS got out at least twice in China. Now, any reasonable investigation into this virus would have looked into that laboratory. Any sensible, sane investigation would have considered that maybe, you know, if it didn't come from this marketplace, maybe it was the virus lab a few miles up the road that had public information, public reporting, public data saying they were researching viruses exactly like this. Why was that not even considered? Not only not considered, but called conspiracy theory. I think these are real things we should be asking. And then why is the CDC not looking into it? Why did the WHO not question that, right? Why are governments not looking into it? It is a major, major disservice to the global public at the time of a global pandemic that this is not seriously being looked into. And so what were they doing at that laboratory? Well, we went and tracked the entire history of their public research. Now, it just so happens that Miss Shi, this Dr. Shi, one of the heads of the laboratory, was one of the leading bat coronavirus researchers in the world. Now, if they were in no way involved with this, interesting, why are they dead silent right now? Why are they not making a peep? And in addition to that, why do they put out internal alerts, which were made public, alerting their own staff before this whole thing went public to not talk to the media that something had happened? Why did they do that? And it just so happens, too, there were multiple whistleblowers from within the laboratory who came out and even used their real names and said this virus came from our laboratory. They came out publicly and said this virus came from our laboratory. And what happened with them? Why is the world not talking about this? Why is this not being looked into? So you have, in other words, people at this lab saying this came from our laboratory, using their real names, trying to tell the whole world. We've been lied to twice on the origin and the intermediary species. Why is this not being looked into? And so this documentary, I think, really, what I hope at the very least, is it would raise these questions in people's minds.
No, it's incredible. And the other thing that just, you know, sort of strikes me at this moment is, you know, if there'd be any group that should be researching perhaps all these kinds of questions, but the whole sort of origin, it would be this P4 lab, which is uniquely qualified to in theory, figure out all these questions, but it doesn't seem to be involved in doing any of this, right?
Well, and that's the thing, too. I mean, I've been researching the Chinese Communist Party, exposing their overseas operations since 2008. I've seen how they operate. When it comes to issues like this, in any normal circumstance, that laboratory, the most advanced virus research lab they have in China, and their hero researcher, who just so happens to be the globally recognized expert on these exact types of viruses, in any normal circumstance, that laboratory and this researcher would be called the heroes of China. They would be used in every single propaganda ad. They'd be put up in the public eye and broadcasted everywhere as the people trying to save China. And it would make the regime look good. And why are they not doing that? In 2018, that's what they were doing. When it came to other virus outbreaks in China, that's what they were doing. Why are they silent now, when a virus is spreading around the world that is exactly in line with their expertise?
Josh, the last I heard, Dr. Shi is nowhere to be found. What's the update?
Yeah, I think the entire world should be asking China that question right now. We should really be asking that question right now, and we're not being told the answer to that. Not only that, but what happened to these whistleblowers? Where are they now? What happened to these rumors of this woman, this young girl who was working at that laboratory, who was called Patient Zero, who in China is suspected of being Patient Zero, and who they erased from their website, even though you can still find information on her there? What happened to her? The Chinese Communist Party is not telling us.
And so, but some of this research is, for example, done to do, you know, vaccine development and so forth. Isn't that right?
Yeah, some is done to do vaccine development. I mean, it's not clear what they were doing exactly. Maybe they were developing vaccines and it got out. Maybe they'd had bat coronaviruses on store and it got out. And I mean, here's the issue too, okay? We're not saying this is a bioweapon. It could be anything. We don't want to jump to conclusions on it. I think we need to, you know, put aside all the conspiracies, put aside all the nonsense, put aside all the politics, and start looking at this seriously. Why are we not looking into this laboratory? Now, in any practical sense, that would have been the first place we looked. Because we can look at the history of the research they did, we can look at the nature of this virus, we can look at the virus sequence, and we can look at how these things relate. And it just so happens that is the most likely place we should be looking. At the very least, it should have been part of the natural inquiry, because leaks like this are not uncommon. Now, all the nature of how it got out aside, or the nature of the research they were doing aside, who knows? Let's put it this way. When it comes to the Chinese Communist Party, the State Department, even just very recently, before this outbreak happened, had a public paper talking about the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare programs. There's a few things it noted that are interesting. Now, the Chinese Communist Party, when it signed on to this Biological Warfare Act in 1984, they never even acknowledged the programs we knew they had before that. The United States knew the Chinese Communist Party had biological warfare programs. When they signed that, they never acknowledged any programs that we knew they had. They never showed any signs of getting rid of the programs we knew they had. And when it comes to biological weapons, let's be clear, most developed countries have biological weapons programs. They don't call them offensive programs, though. They call them defensive programs. Mm. And that's the veil used to justify a lot of that research.
So this is an incredible body of knowledge that you've put together here. And so what can people expect if they watch?
Well, I think what I hope people will come away with is the context of information on all the stuff we hear coming out of China. And also just a collection of facts that they can take and draw their own conclusions with. Now, what I've seen a lot of, at least when it comes to a lot of Western analysis, is that oftentimes it's conclusions based on incomplete information. Now, you can look at, say, the Nature magazine, for example, just had a report saying this virus did not come from a laboratory. If you actually read that paper, what do you see? It just so happens they give significant evidence that it could have been man-made, but they draw the opposite conclusion. Many people have pointed out it's not a scientific piece, it's an opinion piece. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens, too, that Nature came out and wrote a public letter stating that they're apologizing now for having linked the virus to China, because the WHO came out and called it COVID-19, not the China coronavirus, COVID-19, and they're worried that calling it the China coronavirus or linking it to China will cause racism. And this is a terrible problem I think we have right now. Now, let's be clear. At the Epoch Times, we call it the CCP virus, Chinese Communist Party virus. This is not the China virus. This is not about the Chinese people. The Chinese people are the biggest victims of the Chinese Communist Party. It is a murderous dictatorship. It is a system that has killed between 50 million and 70 million people under Mao Zedong alone. It's a system that to this day brutally puts down protests, that will persecute any religion, Falun Gong, House Christians, Tibetan Buddhists, you name it, Muslim Uyghurs thrown in concentration camps. We know they're doing this, right? And so why is it that calling out the Chinese Communist Party at a time like this, when their cover-up of this virus, they're lying to the world about this virus, even Iran is calling them out for this now, they're lying to the world about the danger of this virus, about how serious it was, covering up the death toll in China, which just about every major media is starting to report on now because they're actually seeing it now, that different nations are filing lawsuits against the Chinese Communist Party for covering this up, for lying to them, right? Who are the victims of this? The Chinese people and every single person who gets infected around the world, every single business that goes out of business, who will be held accountable, right? And so calling it the CCP virus is honest. That is honest, right? Not letting this be covered up is honest. And when it comes to scientific analysis that wants to hide the fact of what the origin of it was because of political correctness, that is, in my opinion, not being compassionate to the real victims of this.
Okay, we are out of time. Fascinating. And we will see you all next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye. And we will see you all again next week.